Welcome. I am your host. Well, this is, I will tell you what the show is first, I guess. This is Open Mind UFO Radio, and I am your host, Alejandro T. Rojas, and I am here with, and I've used this name before, but I'm just going to use it again because it explains the noise you hear. I am here with Martin Highwayman Willis.
Yes, I'm sorry, I'm sitting right not too far from the highway.
Oh,
I'm not on the highway.
Good, good. So did you, like, when I called you Highwayman last time, you kind of took that to heart and you thought that would be fun to kind of wait by the highway and jump on people and rob them like the old highwaymen used to do in the olden days? That's not what you're doing, is it?
Not this time, but no. It's funny, after you did that segment, I don't know if you got email. I think I passed it along to you. Someone from England says it's an English saying.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah, yeah. Someone who accosts people on the highway. So, or are you like, you have a cardboard sign up trying to collect money for your show? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, well, these are desperate times, my friend. No. No, I'm just getting my car repaired. That's all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Everything's good.
Yeah.
Well, those are some other exciting scenarios that might have been fun. So, thank you so much for joining me, even though you are busy out and about running your errands, getting your car fixed and everything. The guest that I've got today is Mark D'Antonio. And you know what's funny, and we talk about this on the show, it's hard to really encapsulate what he is. When it comes to UFOs, he is the MUFON photo analyst. However, he does so much more, building models, working on commercials and movies and blah, blah, blah. And he has a degree in astronomy. And that's in particular what we're going to talk about, because you all may have been following the news. Hopefully you follow Open Minds on the Facebook group or our weekly headlines, or even, you know, the stories that I post on my Facebook page. And there's been a lot going on when it comes to astrobiology and the potential of extraterrestrial life out there. So that's what Mark and I are going to discuss.
Great. Mark, I love Mark. He's awesome.
Thank you very much. I'm laughing because of the kind of delayed comment. You got the cue that that was your space to add something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got it. Yeah.
But before what was that?
No, we have a bad connection.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Good. No problem. Damn it. Doing the show from the highway, for God's sakes. So, but before we get into talking to Mark, of course, we're going to talk about UFOs. Are you seeing any UFOs now, Martin?
Not right now.
Okay, well, keep an eye out.
The day is young, yes.
Yeah, and you're outdoors, so if you see something, you know, while we're talking about the news, feel free to interrupt and say, UFO, UFO, and then describe what you're seeing.
All right.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll keep my eye on
eye
in the sky.
Yeah. Good. So, UFO news, you got a story you want to talk about?
I do. This one, I don't want to say silly, but it's interesting anyway. In Washington, D.C., back on October 2nd, just a couple of days ago, this guy was walking, I think he said home from work, and he noticed a strange object hovering in the sky. It was about 30 or 40 feet up and about somewhere around 60 or 70 feet away from him. And if you look at the pictures, it looks to me like a balloon. He said at first he thought it was the helium balloons that you, or the balloons that you make those animals out of, you know, those long, thin ones there.
Oh, yeah.
But then he said they if that was filled with helium, then why was it just sitting in one spot, or appeared to be anyway, for about 3 minutes? And while he was taking a bunch of pictures of it, it is a really another strange, just like last week, another strange looking object. To me, it looks like balloons. But then he ran across the street and tried to get himself right underneath it, and it was gone. It was nowhere to be found. So I thought it was kind of an interesting, you know, picture. Anyway, he did look for any sign of any wire or ribbon or string holding it down. He didn't see any sign of that as well. So it's just one of those, you know, it's an oddball, strange object.
Yeah, kind of funny. Someone commented that it looks like the symbol for, you know, formerly known as, like, you know, when Prince was going under a symbol instead of a name, that it looks like that. Oh. Which is kind of funny. But it does, it looks like a balloon animal gone wrong. Or, like, if I were to attempt to do a balloon animal, that's probably what it would look like. But, and it just floated off or something. That's what it looks like. So it is kind of weird. Although it looks kind of larger than that, I guess it's hard to tell. But, yeah, that's an interesting one. We just posted today. Weird.
Maybe that's a genetically modified balloon animal.
Maybe.
You never know. Yeah.
You never know.
Could be.
You know, Black Project type of thing.
That's right. Yeah.
So another weird one. Lots of weirdness going on. I guess that's what the field of UFOs is. But this is a Colorado witness who says he photographed metallic objects. So another photo story. He said he saw five objects he felt were moving at about 30,000 feet. He could not identify. It was 4 p.m. on September 25th. And he says his wife saw it first. She calls him out. And they look at these weird things floating around. He said they seem to fluctuate in brightness, potentially from changing its position with respect to the sun. Which I kind of agree. It does look like these things are reflective because they're just really weird shaped. And it's hard to even describe the shape. One of them is sort of an S kind of shape. And parts of them are reflecting. And just kind of weird, like these sky amoebas that are reflecting. They were in Superior, which is in Boulder County, near Boulder, Colorado. And, just kind of really strange. Did you see those pictures?
I did not get a chance to look at them today, no.
Well, here's a...
We'll have to check it out.
Do that. Another weird one is in West Virginia. And this is kind of funny because what happens is Roger will post the videos and then he'll write the story. Well, he posted the video. This is Roger Marsh of MUFON, another MUFON case. And people thought the video looked stupid. And they were all upset. This is retarded. This is a star. And the video is bad. You can't tell much. But this witness, what these people didn't know who were watching the video, this witness also took some pictures. And in the pictures, you can tell that the object is just not one point of light, but several points of light, which makes the case much more interesting. So, I mean, they videotaped it with their phone. They said their phone sucks at videotapes, which is true. And then they took some pictures, and the pictures are weird. So, and it all started when in West Virginia, outside of a place called the Stonewall Resort, where this guy was going to do, getting to his work. And this was at 6:18 a.m., so he works early. This was on September 5th. They went to the top of this hill where they get their machinery out, where it was still dark, and he saw this really bright light. So, him and his buddies saw it. They felt it wasn't an airplane. It didn't move like that. So that's when he videotaped it and got some pictures. And, it wasn't until he got home and zoomed on it that he saw it was kind of strange. So you can see that in the picture that it is very strange.
How about that? Now, I wonder if the new iPhone 7 has any better video quality. I know that they really did improve the camera options and quality, so I'm wondering if the video is going to be better.
Because you always hear it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when you try to video something, especially at night, it does not come out well at all. So maybe we'll get some real good footage if it has improved.
Yeah. Yeah, so pretty cool. There's another video I'm going to write about today. I did. You can find it on our news. I don't know if you saw this one from Bolton. It turns out it's a MUFON case. This person got something weird on their security camera. They were afraid of robbers, so they set up a security camera. Something made the security camera go off. They think maybe it was their cat. But in this security video, which is only 40 or so seconds long, towards the end of the video, you see this weird light above the houses in the distance, and it goes behind one house, and then you see, you know, once it goes past the crest of the top of the house, it goes by again, but it makes a left-hand turn and then comes flying in front of the house. And then the video cuts out. Of course, people are really upset. Why did you stop the video? But they didn't stop it. You know how the security cameras just do it themselves. Mm. And it's just trying to record something close, not something in the sky. So, you know, it turned off. But that's another really weird video. I was able to look into the MUFON case. Roger sent me some more information about the case that what they discovered there, the researchers in the UK. So I'm going to write about this one. But that's another one to look forward to, strange video.
Yeah, there's some pretty interesting security camera videos in the past that are kind of unexplained. Really interesting ones. So, yeah, it makes you wonder, especially in England. You know, they say there's not a lot of sightings in England because of the weather. But they have that, I forget what it's called, like the cat TV or whatever it is.
CCTV.
Yeah.
Yeah, where they have cameras all everywhere. Over the place. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So they're bound to catch something one of these days.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the English papers write about UFOs so much. Of course, there's a tabloid who write mostly junk and really poor stuff. A lot of secure team or these fake hoaxers. But the legitimate papers, the local papers and the legitimate ones, they also write a lot about UFOs. But they're like this. They're sightings that are submitted to them or more credible stories. And they've been writing a lot about this stuff, and this is another one of those interesting ones. Now, it appears they talked to the witnesses themselves, so I'll use the quotes that this local paper got. But then these people also luckily went to MUFON, so we have both sets of statements from the witnesses, who seem very credible, just kind of curious. And when you see this, the video is really weird.
I can't wait to see it. I haven't seen that yet.
Ma'am, you're going to have to get to a computer
I know.
When your car is fixed.
That's right, yeah.
Drive straight to the closest computer. Don't try to look while you're driving, though.
Yeah, well, my neck hurts because I've been looking up in the sky. And the only thing I've seen so far is buzzards. That's it.
Buzzards?
I think they're flying. Yeah, I think they're flying over me, but I'm not sure.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, that's kind of scary. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
All right. Well,
but no UFOs.
No UFOs at all.
No, not yet. No.
Any weird-looking people who could be aliens?
I'm in the state of Maine. Okay. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah.
A lot of weird-looking people, huh?
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know. I really shouldn't say anything.
Okay. Yeah.
I just stay out of Walmart, that's all.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, things can get scary. That's where things go down. And
we're
coming up on the holiday season, so these Black Friday sales and stuff, that's when people lose their lives in the Walmart. So
that's right.
Yeah, coming up here. So, all right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Martin, for joining us for the UFO news once again.
My pleasure, as always.
Okay, be safe out there, buddy. And let's go ahead.
Right.
and talk to Mr. D'Antonio. I am excited as usual. I'm always excited when I introduce a guest. I think there's only once or twice where I haven't said I'm excited to have this person on, and I purposely left it out, but to give you some insight. But this guy I'm really excited about because this is my homeboy Mark D'Antonio.
Hey, how you doing, Alejandro? Thanks for having me on that show of yours, which is just going like gangbusters out there. Open Minds is fantastic.
Well, thank you so much, my friend. Thank you very much. It's great to have you back, and there's actually a lot to talk about. I've had you on, I guess, quite a few times probably, but, you know, I want to talk about a lot of what we talked about in our panel that you hosted at the MUFON Symposium.
I remember that.
Yeah, some kind of astrobiological type of stuff, and there is lots of news out there, and, you know, a lot of people read the science news, they kind of get it, and then pretend like when they're talking to other people that they get it more than they do, and I'm describing myself, but I know some other listeners are like this. But you actually know a little bit more, although you're probably pretending a little bit too.
I don't know a thing. I actually have been pretending this whole time. I have no clue.
But you have a degree in astronomy, correct?
I don't even know your real name.
You said it. How do you say it, by the way? I don't know. Do you pronounce it well?
What's that?
My name. Say my name.
Alejandro Rojas.
Oh, yeah, that's very good. Some people, I've had friends that I've known for years.
They call you Alejandro?
Yeah, they call me Alejandro. Or something.
Yeah, yeah. And someone call you Alejandro. I heard that one, too.
Yeah, that's funny. So I guess we'll start off. We'll start off with the big star. And here's why. I posted a story today, and people got really bummed. And I was like, hey, hold up. You know, I'm going to talk to Mark about this today. And I suspect it isn't as, you know, doom and gloom as it says. But some people may know about this star out there. Now it's called Tabby Star, where Kepler, you know, is out there looking for planets. It looks for stars to dim and can kind of calculate the planets. You can give us some more technical details on that. And there's a star out there that's dimming weird. The scientists looking at it have suggested maybe there's an alien megastructure there. So this is real excited. We've been talking about this. You and I have talked about this on the show before.
Yeah, we have.
But a new story, this is a headline, came out. Kepler data glitch, not aliens, could be to blame for wacky star behavior, says leading astrophysicist. Dun, dun, dun.
What does leading mean? What does leading mean? And what does astrophysicist mean?
Oh, yeah, good. So what were your initial thoughts when you hear this?
Well, initially there were several theories as to why this star would be dimming for such a long period of years, and that actual dimming process is something that has been continuing. The star hasn't been getting really bright and then getting dim and then really bright. I mean, it's actually been gradually dimming over time, from what I've seen in the data. And that said, they said, well, you know, the latest theory is that maybe it was a collision of a planet with another planet in that solar system causing, say, an asteroid belt to be forming. And so we were watching this dimming as this belt material started to coalesce into a ring around the star or whatever. That was one theory. Another theory put forth by someone that I know suggested that maybe these dimming sequences were actually part of a swarm of comets that were getting between us and that star, Tabby Star, and causing it to dim over time. That was discounted. The asteroid belt theory hasn't been fully discounted at this point, but the comets have. And now there is the possibility that the Kepler telescope itself is responsible for this dimming. Now, I haven't read the full data on how technically the dimming could be occurring, because to me, on the outside anyway, looking in, to say that this is a dimming caused by the instrument itself, I have to respond with, wait a minute, the instrument's supposed to be looking for dimming. That's what it's doing. That's what it does. So this would imply a fundamental flaw in the entire Kepler program. Maybe I'm over exaggerating. Maybe I'm dramatizing a little, over being over dramatic. But I think that this would be on the outside. I think it's probably a theory that would fit multiple stars, not just the one Tabby star. Mm-hmm. We should have seen this occurring with other stars, and maybe it is. Maybe we have to readdress all of our findings, except that when you see a dimming with Kepler, that's not what determines whether a planet is in existence. It actually has to be corroborated by a secondary technique independent of Kepler and light curve analysis. Now, light curve is when the star is out there and you have the planet that crosses in front of the star and it dims the light ever so slightly from the star. And I mean ever so slightly, with emphasis on all three words. And that minuscule, minute amount of difference is something that the Kepler telescope is good at picking up. So that's one way to actually see that there's dimming. That produces a, you know, a Kepler object of interest and a candidate planet. And then several years will pass before that planet is identified as existing or not existing. And that existence will be based on corroboration through radial velocity or another astrometry type approach to the star. Another way, another technique used to measure whether there is something going on at that star other than just a light dimming.
Now, is Kepler the only device they've used to measure or observe this dimming with?
I think so. I think that the Kepler is the only satellite space-based telescope that actually looked at this star. I think that's what discovered that this dimming was occurring currently with Tabby star. But I think the star has been observed before, and I'm frantically, as we're speaking, looking for corroboration of that, because I want to make sure that I'm not speaking out of turn here.
Well, and a couple other things I can add. How do you say her name anyway? Dr. Tabitha Boyajian?
Boyajian. Well done. I mean, I'm an astronomer. I'm not a pronunciation specialist, so I'll go with you on that one.
I think that's what it is. But the point is, the star is now called Tabby star, because we used to refer to it as KIC, blah, 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 right. All these numbers.
And that's easier than saying Boyajian star.
Yeah, exactly. And so she says that she also thought maybe it was a data issue with the Kepler. And he talks about, you know, having to do with pixels or something like that. But she says she looked at that very closely. And now many, many people have confirmed that they all feel confident it's not this data issue. So he wasn't the first one, the guy who they're writing this story about, Dr. Brad Tucker.
Yeah.
He's not the first one to come up with this idea, and he admits that he says here, I don't discount the literally hundreds of other people that have thought about this, but for at least my own understanding, I want to make sure I'm confident that this really is an awesome star. So he's just doing his own due diligence, it sounds,
sure.
And this newspaper just decided to make a story about it. But before you fear that this whole thing's been poo-pooed and figured out.
It has not.
It really hasn't.
No. No, and now he's just the latest guy, as you said, in the chain of astronomers and researchers that have this, you know, have already looked at this data. And as you say, they probably decided to make a story out of this. But I don't see a story yet. And that's because the very thing he is saying is the problem is the actual mechanism by which the Kepler works. And I would have thought, as anyone would familiar with space-based telescopes, that such a problem would have been figured out long ago, like when the Hubble had a bad mirror grinding. They actually produced bifocals for it and installed it up in orbit. Now, that's an example of something getting away from us and then actually getting to orbit with a flaw. And there's numerous satellites that have had flaws in orbit later on, found to be, you know, unfixable and lost, you know, for the reasons like the Hitomi satellite went up there and it was lost, you know, a short time after it was launched. And that was, again, all because of something that may be related to ground technique or capability or whatever. So we have no share. We have our share of failures that were caused by us. Mm-hmm. And Kepler could be in that category, but I tend to think that we're seeing something that is hard to explain as a natural phenomenon. That's just my feeling. And I'm not mm-hmm. trying to say aliens. Okay. I need bigger hair for that. Ba-dum-bum. But I would say that the jury is still out in a big way. And I think we just need to keep looking at the star. You know, another couple years of study of the star will be very telling.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess, are you familiar with the crowdsourcing thing that they did around Tabby Star?
No, I'm not actually familiar with it.
Yeah, it was just a group I remember, and I was going to find out if you knew. They are raising money so they can observe Tabby Star constantly, so they can record the effects. And I just was wondering whether they were going to use solely Kepler's data or they were going to look with something else. Are there other telescopes capable of measuring this dimming that we
yeah.
have?
Yeah, I mean, we have a number. In fact, I just talked to the guy who was running the test mission, which is the next, basically the next generation space telescope that's going to be launched soon. He's the guy in charge of it, and he's a real nice guy, and he thinks that, you know, that telescope will be able to show us some fantastic views of the sky and do the same types of things that Kepler did with additional clarity and ability. So I think tasking TESS, to say it that way, tasking TESS to look at that star for a period of time might be a very good thing to do, especially if it stands to be a historic observation. And that's an example of one that's to be launched. I mean, there's other programs, Earth-based programs, that are looking for other planets around stars. You know, the Gemini telescope on Mauna Kea is fantastic. I talked to those guys and got imagery to use in the talks that I do here and there. And they're finding things by actually looking at infrared residue, infrared hangout, you know, left over from the formation of a planet. The planet's still warm. It's radiating, although it's not very visible in the the other part of the spectrum. It's visible in the infrared. Same thing around a star called Fomalhaut. Okay, it's actually got a tiny planet that's orbiting it that was found in the infrared again. And you know, they call that direct observation because infrared is actually pretty close to the visible end of the spectrum at that point. So they basically say it's a direct observation. So we do have a ground-based and some space-based capability coming that are going to allow us to put this matter to rest.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. And I found that Kickstarter. People can look it up, and I won't go through it, but I had looked through it before. What's really cool about this Kickstarter is that, and that's what's exciting about this whole thing, is that there are several astronomers that have made comments about that they got quotes from or interviews with to talk about the importance of observing Tabby Star. And for mm-hmm. the most part, they're very conventional, talking about we don't know what is causing this. It could be this and it could be that. But the majority of them ended their talk with essentially saying that, you know, and of course the most incredible possibility is that it's due to the actions of some extraterrestrial civilization. And of course that would be an amazing discovery. So that's what's great about this is that, you know, scientists are the ones who came forward with this idea first, not some weird fringe YouTuber, UFO person or something. It was the actual scientists. And many of them...
Tabitha mm-hmm. herself is the one that started that Kickstarter.
So it's really exciting that, the scientists are just, you know, so strongly open-minded about this possibility.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, I'm just got to the page now, and I see that, you know, observatories are donating to this Kickstarter. A lot of folks in the business are donating to this. It's just to get the answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not paying for aliens to be there. You're paying to get an answer as to mm-hmm. whether it's possible they are. And every one of these people that contributed may not ever get the answer in their lifetime,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, kind of sad, but it's where we are right now in our technological development. We can't send any kind of faster than light FTL type craft to the star. It's, what, 1,500 light years away, isn't it? I mean, that's pretty distant. So it would take 1,500 years at light speed to get there. And we can't travel that, but we can, you know, do this the warping of space game that we've talked about a number of times, you and I. And NASA's actually got a lab now to investigate the feasibility of such a drive, because the concept has been reworked so that a potential quote-unquote warp drive may actually be just around the cosmic corner. For us, it's a lifetime away, but it's just around the cosmic corner, perhaps. For the Earth. So this could lead to the ability to just say, well, I think we saw something there. Okay, we'll send a probe there and let me know what it says next week.
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that kind of thing, and we laugh now because it's so far science fiction, but that's coming, and that is going to reach us, and we are getting there. And if we're doing it, I always have to say, if we're doing it, some other civilization out there that's ahead of us by 1,000 years, 4,000 years, 500 years, has already done it and is probably mm-hmm. thinking of it. We're not the first, but I think we're probably right there in the middle. We're not the youngest, but we're not the oldest. And there's a lot of them out there. You know, that's my belief anyway. And that's yours. I know that is.
Hmm. Well, and another interesting thing is, and you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this is, we're kind of on the outskirts of the galaxy, right?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, our position in the galaxy is in this particular arm of the galaxy, and we're actually, about 2/3 of the way out, maybe. So we're kind of in the middle of this arm. So it's really, you know, it's sort of a position where a lot of stars have formed. I mean, every star you see in the Big Dipper, we came from the cluster of stars that were formed all at the same time, which included all the stars you see in the Big Dipper, which is why it's so prominent in our sky. Now they've all migrated apart as they're moving and circling the galaxy over time. But, you know, we have actually become a landmark location, because where we are in the galaxy, all right, is a location that we haven't even been able to fully explore. We barely know where we are, you know, in the galaxy. We know we're in the Orion Spur, but we don't know exactly where. Okay, you know, the stars of Orion are nearby, and that's why they're also so bright. Okay, and, you know, you ask, what is nearby? You know, what is nearby? We're a galaxy that's,
didn't ask that.
You didn't ask that?
Was going to, though. You're right.
Okay, well, if you do ask that, you say, you know, what does nearby mean? Well, nearby is like, you know, 500 light years, 1,000 light years. Now, we think of, you know, Proxima Centauri, where where a planet has been found, circling that nearest star to us. And we think that's nearby, all right? We think that's a hop, skip, and a jump. That's actually very close. And 500 light years is still close, considering that the galaxy is, you know, 100,000 light years across or more.
Mm-hmm.
So
now, I want to make a point too, that, because I don't know that we've really discussed this, and I think it's important to talk about just what a fascinating person you are, kind of a modern Renaissance man. That you're not only the photo analyst and stuff for MUFON, when it comes to astronomy, and you build models and all of this other stuff, but when it comes to astronomy, this is something that you actually utilize in your professional life as well. I know, for instance, you build, and you have large contracts for building, like, the planets of the solar systems, at scale for events and for places.
That's true. I mean, we have a we did a whole scale solar system for a science museum in Turkey.
Oh wow!
And Jupiter was massive, and of course the Earth was small. You know, but we have ongoing projects where we're doing these big solar system models for all this new construction across the country. We've got over 200 buildings to fill with new solar systems that will keep us busy for many years to come. And you know, we've done most recently, we actually did some NASA work. We did some Martian globe for NASA that was really nice, and that ended up on a 16-foot tall tower on display, illuminated from inside. You know, so the planets, you can't argue with an astronomer who knows, you know, what the planets look like, right? I mean, and there should be no equivocation. You know, if you don't know if that detail's there, you're not going to put it on there. Mm-hmm. Whereas someone else who doesn't know the planet would say, they'll never notice and just put it on. You know, but we're not like that. You know, we're doing 3D models of these planets. I say 3D meaning the craters were in relief, and we did Mars. That was my favorite planet to do, because we would do all the valleys, rift valleys, and all the craters and volcanoes on Mars as relief items and then indented items into the planet. So Valles Marineris, this gigantic valley on Mars, the Mariner Valley on Mars, was a deep gouge in our model going around the center of the planet. And I say deep at that scale of it was a 40-inch planet. At that scale, it was a quarter inch deep, but that was huge on a model. But we did it that way because it caught the light and it looked nice. So, yeah, and every crater was where it's supposed to be. And when you put a light on it from the outside, you'd think you're looking at Mars, you know, because it looked like Mars. The polar cap was exactly as it should be. It's a really interesting shape, and we reproduced that. I laser cut stencils. We have a laser cutter here, and we laser cut stencils to get that just right. And Doug Trumbull was working with me. He wanted me to kick it up even a bigger notch and said, why don't you just build a system to actually paint them automatically and just rotate them and have them paint, you know, like a automatic process. And I said, Doug, I'd love to do that. You know, I mean, I could use, any number of hardware processors that we know how to program here to do it. But I just never had the time to do it. He had a great idea, though. Mm-hmm. You know, I mention him because he's your favorite. You know,
yeah,
he's your favorite guy.
Yeah, I'm a huge, huge fan, and it gives me a chance to plug the interview we had. You were there, but we posted an interview we had with Doug with some great imagery that Michael Klein put together, and I love that interview. So you can watch that for free on YouTube. And
it was very good, by the way. It was well done.
Thank you very much. And Doug Trumbull's a movie, you know, special effects guru now, and that brings me to another question. You worked with Doug on the iPad Pro commercial where it goes into space, and it's just an amazing commercial. Apple used it to, you know, even at their launch of the Apple iPad Pro. And you know, it's when you all worked on that, did you also use, you know, your astronomy knowledge to recreate the galaxies and things like that?
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, to create Jupiter's red spot, we created this giant spherical tank, and we spun it on a computer controlled turntable, and then these guys dropped in dye at specific places, and the swirling motion, the friction of the water on the acrylic wall, would draw these things out into a perfect red spot. So we actually recreated Jupiter's red spot just beautifully, and it even had 3D depth to it, which is the coolest thing. And then we created a comet, which didn't actually get into the commercial, but it was principal footage that was shot and might be making an appearance later.
Cool.
And the comet was I plumbed it for liquid nitrogen so that we could actually shoot liquid nitrogen out of it, and then a burst of air as well, so that, because it was made up in pieces that all interlocked. It was like an interlocking puzzle, like a physical Tetris thing, all chunky rock-looking stuff. And when the computer would bring the camera down underneath the comet, And this all happened in about 2.5 seconds, but it was shot at very high speed, so it was a slow motion, beautiful slow motion comet. It would break apart and shower down onto the camera with pieces of itself, and it looked like you were traveling into the tail of the comet. You just have to see the perspective to understand how, because you're seeing it from the camera's point of view. And this was beautiful, and the whole time liquid nitrogen was raining down because we were, you know, just blasting liquid nitrogen into this thing, and it was dropping out of the holes and spraying out behind it. It looked like a comet tail. And of course, you light it dramatically, and it's beautiful. So it's all about special effects, but we had to create the comet to look real. So when Doug says, okay, I want you to make the comet, I said, okay, I'll make the comet, and I know what to make it. I showed him the first time, and he says, what the heck is that? I said, that's a comet. And he says, it's black. I go, yeah, comets are black. You didn't know that? And he says, oh, that's not going to work. And I said, don't worry. When we put the liquid nitrogen in there, it's going to produce a frost. It's actually going to look white on camera. In fact, you're going to have to cut down the f-stops to make it look right. And so he saw that it was correct, and we did it. Then we did another sequence of a meteor going into the atmosphere where it was leaving this trail of smoke behind it. And for that, we actually had a long, tall, rather, vertical tank that was only about 12 inches wide. It was about 6 feet tall, and it was about, 4 feet or 5 feet across. So it was like a very thin, almost window profile water tank, okay, just a little thicker. So, and what we did was we created pieces of the meteor, and we soaked them in white paint. We just injected, using a syringe, we injected white paint into the little holes and the grooves that we had put in it. And then we started shooting at 1,600 frames per second. And all we did was drop them into the water. And as they dropped into the water, they sailed down, leaving a trail of all this white, cloudy smoke behind them. But no one knew that there was these were in water, because when they were composited against an atmosphere and moving under you horizontally into the atmosphere, it would actually look like, and it did look like, smoke trailing behind a comet. Behind a meteorite. So, and so we got to use the astronomy and to do that there. And you know, I was his. He jokingly calls me his chief scientist. You know, when we do these things, he wants it all right, because he's not like George Lucas in suspending disbelief. He actually suspends disbelief only to the point where we might be able to see that belief in reality in 100 years or so. So he actually is more of a realistic science fiction guy.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. That's so cool. And you know what? You know, I love to hear these and how fun it would be. I mean, when I wanted to be a rocket scientist at first. When I went to school, it was for aerospace engineering at CU Boulder. Well, that was my intent. I was in engineering. But in physics, you know, in high school, when I got into the advanced physics and everything, it changed the way I kind of viewed the world, really, because, like, clouds, you know, that's why I love the liquid methods that you use often, because, you know, when the atmosphere, and I think it's a good way to think of it, is like that layering of
it so is.
And so the clouds are kind of scooting across one layer of the atmosphere, and I think that helps me to understand that's why you have all these different layers, and it makes you understand that, you know, just because the wind speed is in one direction at one location or at one height, that at another elevation, it could be totally different, which is important for this field because...
it so is, you're right.
You have to be aware of that, as you know.
Yeah, ground speed, ground winds are not the same as winds aloft, and many times, you know, people say it was very calm, yet this thing was racing across the sky. That's because on the ground, the speed was near zero. But once you reach that stratified layer in the air, say 250 feet up, then that thing, which might be a balloon, for instance, was scooting along in that wind column. And, you know, people don't recognize that, nor do they recognize the three-dimensionality of the world. You know, like contrails seen coming at you will look like vertical lines in the sky. They're often mistaken for rocket launches, and you know this.
Mm-hmm.
I know this. And so the first thing I do is try and figure out, okay, I believe that's probably an airplane. It's moving too slow to be a rocket. So which airplane is it? And that's readily available from ADS-B data and other information. You can actually figure out what aircraft it was, for instance. So, you know, having a knowledge of the atmosphere as a medium that mm-hmm. leaves tracks and traces. The clouds are an artifact in an atmosphere. They're an area in the atmosphere where the density is different. They're an area in the atmosphere where the components are slightly more concentrated or different. And then translating that to creating a visual effect, say, is sort of a piece of cake. You just find, you know, if we want to create clouds, then we have to create dyes, for instance, that won't dissipate and stay pretty much together while you release them. And thus you have the appearance of a thick cloud, okay, creating nebulas. We create a lot of nebulas this way. Everything you saw, and if you saw the iPad Pro commercial, you know, Great Big Universe, everything you saw in there except at the end was all done practically, meaning it was all done with an actual physical effect. There weren't any CGI components before that.
Mm-hmm.
When they pulled out and showed the iPad on the screen and the person fingering, you know, the screen and moving around, that was all, you know, the CGI stuff. But everything up to that point was real, you know, actually done in this.
Yeah. So cool.
We saw it just like you saw it, which is really cool. Yeah.
And that reminds me of another effect that you worked on. And I mean, to lead into that, it has to do with a big NASA announcement. And this is what's funny. Now, NASA keeps doing this, and it's always kind of a, I think especially for the general public, it's kind of a cry wolf type situation where NASA says, we're going to have a press conference because we figured something out really cool. And I think scientists get a little more excited about some of this stuff than the layman. But, of course, you and I get excited about it.
Of course
but
you do.
There's also this kind of allusion to astrobiology and the discovery of alien life. And the media especially is always like, are they going to tell us they found – you know, an alien microbe or something like this. And that typically doesn't turn out to be the case. Even in this one, NASA said, it's not alien life. They even came out and said, we're not going to be talking about that. But they did talk about, it's somewhat related in that they feel that it, and you can explain how, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
I think you're going to tell me about the icy geysers of Enceladus.
Exactly. Enceladus.
Yeah. Enceladus is a little 300-mile diameter moon of Saturn, and it's covered in ice, thick ice. It has a mantle of ice on it, and I mean a mantle meaning covering, not the mantle of the planet. But and this covering of ice has cracks in it. Now, it's not the orbit is not perfectly circular, so at one point in its orbit, Saturn's gravity actually compresses the moon a little bit. Actually, tidal forces squeeze the moon and cause those cracks to open up. And that's when it spews, as we've seen, icy water from its southern hemisphere geysers. Then, after it passes that point in the orbit, that ceases because the gravitational forces are no longer tugging in the same way. The fissures close up and the geysers stop billowing, you know, this ice water. However, what's interesting is, okay, that's the mechanism that causes it. Now, fascinating topic about Enceladus is that this has been happening forever since the moon formed. So we're seeing that there's a lot of material inside of Enceladus to spew out. Now, that led to other studies to indicate maybe Enceladus has a slushy ocean underneath, kind of like Jupiter's moon Europa, and you don't want to confuse the two. Europa's much bigger, all right, has a similar icy sheath, but has up to 100-mile deep ocean beneath its icy crust. Enceladus, on the other hand, is tiny. It might have a slushy water ice component, But we see along that southern hemisphere, we don't see just water. We also see some complex molecules that are being deposited out there. This indicates that we see the building blocks of life, because they're building blocks of life, being formed in a lot of places that seemingly are inhospitable throughout our solar system. And this is very important for when we're looking for life. It's also the premise of the book I wrote called The Populated Universe, which talks about these building blocks of life that are found almost everywhere we look. They're even found in hot Jupiters that are so close to their star that they're not even able to change the direction. They can't orbit. They're actually locked facing the star. That's called tidal locking. And even in the atmospheres of those planets, we've been able to detect some strange compounds and things that are forming. And this is the kind of science that we're heading for. And we're going to, you know, use the science of Enceladus, the science of Europa. We're going to find, I predict, I think we're going to find that Europa around Jupiter now, bigger moon, okay, more ocean. I think we're going to find that the water underneath that crust is highly oxygenated. Now, that means two things. It means, yay, oxygen, that means life could exist. Yes, but it also means highly acidic too, because whenever you have highly oxygenated water, you also have some acidic content, and water can be highly acidic. Now, that doesn't mean life can't exist. Just look in the Yellowstone Hot Springs, for instance, or look at some of these very inhospitable acidic lakes that are on the planet Earth. There's bacteria that are thriving in these environments. So this brings up the concept of extremophiles, extreme forms of life that can live anywhere. And why? And you know this, I think you did a story on this. There's even the microbes on the outside of the International Space Station that were discovered, right? So these are all very important aspects of the search for life. And we're not just searching for life like us. We're searching for life not like us, primarily, because that's probably more readily present.
Mm-hmm. Now, these geysers on Enceladus, the way the story was framed is that NASA wasn't 100% sure there were geysers, but that's what was kind of even more of a letdown from the press release, but that they were saying they're pretty sure, they're a little more sure than they were before, that these geysers exist.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of photos that people can look up online. They show up, you know, these wonderful backlit images of Enceladus, and you can see stuff spewing out of very focused focal points on the moon. This is water ice along with some complex molecules that are being spewed out of there, and it's not that these don't exist. The question you want to ask is, how long will they exist? All right, because it's showing, you know, some of the latest research is actually showing that these geysers are beginning to, I won't say shut down, but they're starting to reduce their output. So it's possible that and it's possible that the narrowing is occurring as stuff maybe is accumulating inside the walls of the geyser. Who knows? But if it's been doing it now, it's probably been doing it in some form for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's changing to a different mechanism. Maybe it's going to seal up. Maybe it periodically opens and then closes after a period of time. We don't know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting that the moon actually has the potential to have an awful lot of water inside. And it also, in another backlit image, you can actually see – in fact, I used this image for one of our displays, actually, at the MUFON conference. There is a torus, that is a ring, if you will, of water ice residue around Saturn in Enceladus's orbit. So over time, it's spread out and made its way around the whole planet. You know, the whole and formed a very faint ring, which is visible in backlight. And this is, you know, part and parcel to the whole thing going on with Enceladus. Now, you might say, well, wouldn't that stuff have just all evaporated already and just gone away? And the answer is yes, it might have. but there's nothing to stop it from just staying there in orbit around Saturn. And as Enceladus, with no atmosphere, collides with it as it moves around its orbit, it's self-replenishing. And this water falls to the surface of Enceladus and, you know, forms new ices and new particles on the surface of Enceladus. And one of the things that happens is that that stuff, instead of building a thicker and thicker ice sheath, it has to be getting recycled in some way back into the interior. This could be through Saturn's inexorable tugging on Enceladus, causing it to the blocks to raise and lower and to basically flip over, say, maybe like an iceberg in the water. And it's recycling some of this material back to the interior, you know. So as it increases this weight, okay, it's pressing down, and so that ice sheath on the surface will start to go dive deeper into the planet. Its own weight will carry it deeper into the planet. On the bottom of that ice sheath inside the planet, the stuff that is there gets melted off and ends up going back up to the surface, because another thing that's happening is that tugging from that moon is causing, or the tugging from Saturn on that moon is causing friction, and that heats things up, and that's why we have water at all, most likely. Or it's the leftover radiation from initial formation. But the bottom line is that that inexorable squeezing causes enough friction and enough heating to melt those subsurface layers of ice into that ocean that's underneath Enceladus. I say ocean, but it's, you know, we don't know.
Right. But either way, it's creating this ring of water that the planet goes through, traverses through, and causing this space rain, essentially.
That's correct. I mean, if you're on Enceladus, you might actually find a fine, misty ice covering on your spacesuit over a period of time. I can't say how much because I don't know the density of this material that's falling on them. But yes, and over time, if you had an instrument that you placed on Enceladus, you would probably find, if you came back 5 years later, that it was encrusted with this ice.
That's crazy.
That's a transport mechanism. Something's transporting it, and it's the orbit of Enceladus itself spewing this up, you know, and then it's that stuff that's spewed out is going to stay in orbit. There's no reason for it to go anywhere else. And as the particles collide with other particles in Enceladus's orbit, they reach an equilibrium velocity, an angular velocity, in which they end up going around the planet the same way as Enceladus
now,
all time.
When it comes to this space rain idea, you're probably aware of this, and I can't say the name of the guy who is the main scientist, Wackenschermby or something like this. It's not because it's anonymous. It's just because I can't pronounce it. But I think it's the University of Edinburgh in conjunction with the University of Alabama. Well, we had Richard Hoover, who's part of this group of astrobiologists. And Hoover worked for NASA and their astrobiology team early on. And he's since retired, but there's still this group of astrobiologists who, for instance, defend the Mars rock that, you know, Clinton famously talked about possibly having evidence of extraterrestrial life, but it's still under debate. He talks about the possibility that Earth experiences space rain. And some of this rain accounts for the red rain that has been, anecdotally talked about, people seeing red rain. And that rain, he feels, could hold, extraterrestrial microbes that could have, you know, kind of brought life to this planet. Do you know much about that topic?
Well, I do know that the red rain has been reported. It's not just red. I mean, it's been different colors. It's been yellow, green, and other colors. And it would stain your clothes. I remember this. Mm. And one of the things that I remember was that it was actually algae that was actually sent airborne through some mechanism.
Mm. Possibly like a water spout.
Well, certainly a water spout would do it indeed, yeah. And this has happened in places like India and other countries where this red rain has occurred. And it, you know, it's called the blood rain, and it, of course, because it's associated with blood, it becomes a very spiritual thing to a number of people.
Mm-hmm. And fact, a water spout, so people know, is when a tornado essentially goes over a body of water.
That's right.
Sucks the water into the air.
It's like a giant straw that pulls that water up and spews it for miles many times. And so it's possible that the red rain has been, I don't know, I mean, I know there's a panspermia, that's obviously the life from out there getting here hypothesis. And we thought that maybe the red rain, I know that the panspermia hypothesis talks about red rain as coming from comets at some point in the past, or meteoric material, that stuff.
Was it possible then that we move through, and I think we have, we move through, let's say, the tail of a comet, and then that ice rains back down on our planet?
Well, I can say, yeah. I mean, of course, it's possible. In fact, it's not only possible, it's guaranteed, because we actually, every time we go through a cometary tail, we see a meteor shower, and that's what meteor showers are. Mm-hmm. It's going through the dust tail of a previously passed comet that came by. So when a comet, you know, the funny thing about comets is they leave a trail behind them the whole way, okay? And this is especially interesting in light of the fact that the Rosetta mission just terminated the past week. And that cometary tail that they leave behind them is actually a dust tail. But there's also a chemical reaction, an electromagnetic reaction that occurs, and there's an ion tail that's also created. Now, the ion tail always points, okay, in a direction that is away from the sun. And the dust tail just goes to wherever the orbit of the comet was. So a comet can have two tails in the sky, and that dust tail is the thing that creates the meteor showers and what you're talking about, the possibility of that cometary rain of debris coming down on our planet. And there's no doubt that this has happened in the past, and in fact, there's no doubt that comets have actually struck us, delivering a huge amount of water to our planet. And when you look at our oceans and the size of our oceans, you say, oh, it couldn't possibly have had that many cometary strikes to make up that kind of water. And that's probably true. But we have had billions of comets strike this planet over time, and that is during the early era of bombardment. In the first billion years or so of our formation, there was an era where we were constantly bombarded by all manner of comets and meteors and asteroids, and in one planetary sized body, which is the thought process behind which the moon was formed, when it hit the Earth and split the Earth off and into a small chunk came out, and that was the moon. So there's that possibility. So the panspermia approach from comets is not so far-fetched, actually, because we certainly owe a great deal of our water to cometary impact from a long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm. So, and if there was some sort of impact and a piece of the Earth detached, it could take with it earthly extremophiles, which then could rain down on some other planet. Populating that planet.
That's an interesting point that no one's ever made, and I like it.
Ooh, thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, the thought is, I give huge credit where credit is due, and that was a good thought. I actually never thought of that. The thought that maybe these impacts hitting Earth took away, I'll call them panspermatic particles. Okay, I don't know what else to call them, that led to some other planet having microbes, maybe Mars. Okay, maybe it was both directions. Maybe we've been struck by Martian asteroids and meteorites in the past, but maybe Mars has been struck by Earth-based asteroids, and maybe any microbes found on Mars might look very much like microbes here, because they came from here.
And this object, should it have dislodged, would have a tail as it went to go seed another planet, so it's kind of like Earth sperm. It's an art sperm at that point. We're you running know, out of time.
I'm sure the look on your face is priceless right now. Okay?
I wish I could see the look on yours.
I mean, the wide eyes and the eyebrows up here. Yeah. Like, I can't believe he just said that. You know?
But speaking of Enceladus and models, you've created a model of Enceladus for NASA's Unexplained Files. Is that true?
Yeah. I've worked on all four seasons of NASA's Unexplained Files, and you know, I go in front of the camera, I do special effects behind the camera as well, and on one occasion, I think it was season one, they talked about Enceladus, and I actually created two models. Hmm. I created one model that we could compress under gravitational influence to show the cracks opening, and then when that compression was released, you'd see the cracks closing. So I created one model of that. And then I created an acrylic sphere model of Enceladus, where I actually created the white surface that looked like ice at that scale. And then I had these tiny holes in it, and I only put 1 PSI of fog inside Enceladus model, just 1 pound per square inch, just slightly higher than normal. And out of those tiny, tiny pinprick holes came spewing these gigantic geysers of fog. Now, at slow motion and filmed properly, it looked just like the backlit image of Enceladus you see, but in motion. So it was really cool.
That's super cool.
It was cool.
Well, that's because you're just a cool dude.
You know what? Anything to make the ends meet, right? You just gotta have fun.
So it sounds like a lot of really fun, cool stuff. Like I said, we're pretty much out of time. Now, people, of course, can find you. You do stuff with MUFON. You do the NASA Unexplained Files, which is on which channel?
That's on Discovery. Oh, and yeah. I also do What on Earth, which is a new series. And that's okay. I can't say which one. I don't remember what channel. It might be Discovery. It might be Science or History Channel. I don't know.
I forgot what channel.
I can't remember. I never get to watch them. I always get to do them. I always have to do them.
Yeah.
You know, What on Earth is coming out in a couple of weeks, and NASA's Unexplained Files just left for the remains of season 4.
Cool.
And I just never know where I'm going with these things. I just get the story list. I start working through it. You know, and we go.
I hope they put you in that cool, what was it, like a red turtleneck.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
I mean, so Jim Oberg can say that I look like the red shirt on Star Trek again?
Yeah, you did look like a red shirt on Star Trek.
Yeah, Jim and I had a nice talk about that. We laughed. You know, he's a very nice guy when it comes to this. He was very good.
Well, so that's where they could find you. Where else can people look for you?
Well, my website, which is outdated because I simply don't have the time to update it, is www.fxmodels.com. That's my special effects website, FX Models. You can also go to DougTrumbull.com and see the kind of work that we've done and that we do up at the studio with Doug.
Including your UFO work that you guys do together.
That's correct. You can see the UFO work. You can see the UFOTOG originating project that created the project we're working on now called UFOTOG 2, which you know all about, and that some of your viewers may know about. It's bringing ufology into the 21st century, albeit slower than we want. But, you know, we are self-funding at this point. We're not looking for anyone yet to provide vast sums of money. We're trying to get this out the door ourselves, and everyone working on the project is working for it free. So, but we are expending a lot of money to try and get this thing to work. Because we know it'll work. It's just, you know, if someone's out there using advanced technology to fly the stars, then they're going to leave what we've termed skid marks in our four-dimensional space when they cross back into it and leave our dimensional space. And that's what we're looking for,
Hunting for skid marks.
Yep. And every 9-year-old kid will laugh his butt off.
Exactly. The 9-year-old kid in each of us was resisting making a joke. But
I think the 9-year-old kid that's in me is the one that came up with that phrase when I called them skid marks. I realized I have no idea what I just started, but I probably shouldn't have. But it's okay. I believe it wholeheartedly. 9-year-olds have skid marks. Okay.
Oh, and a joke came out. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show again. Great as always. You have a good one. Yeah, great to talk to you too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Alejandro, thank you very much.
All right, thanks, man. Thank you so much to Mark D'Antonio for being on the show again. What an interesting, interesting, interesting fella. So he's a lot of fun to talk to, and really interesting. It's great to have someone so knowledgeable in these things to be able to discuss, you know, some of the news, because media doesn't always, you know, get things totally right. I mean, they're not scientists, they're not astronomers, so sometimes it's hard to interpret the stuff, and then you don't get the full story times as well. Plus, there's a lot of implications, so there's a lot of questions and possibilities. So it's a lot of fun to have Mark there to be able to talk to, and it's just fascinating. I hope you all find it very fascinating as well, because I'm mainstream science. It's twofold. First of all, they seem to be on the cusp. They're on the verge of finding some sort of life, even if it's in a microbe. But the second of all, this whole Tabby Star thing just demonstrates how open many scientists are to the idea of extraterrestrial life and even intelligent extraterrestrial life. So I think that's really, really important. Otherwise, thank you so much to Martin for joining us for the news, even though he was out and about today. And thank you to you all for listening. Thank you to Caleb Hanks for the opening and close music. A couple notes when it comes to the UFO Congress. Last Friday was the last day for the super early bird. Oh, you missed it. Oh, no. But you know I love you. So we have created the social media codes, social fool and social speakers. When you register online, if you use those codes, they will be good until Monday. That's right. Almost a week away, 6 days away. They'll be good until then, so you can still get the super early bird special. Huh? Hooking you up, peeps. And the reason that's so important is because the speakers are so cool. I've posted more speakers. I'm posting a speaker this week that's going to be super awesome. You'll hear more about that in time. I might have already told you guys because I tell you guys everything. But anyways, it's going to be really cool. So that's where you'll be able to get remember, it's Social Fool or Social Speakers. Social Fool you use for the full attendance tickets, or if you're getting the speaker-only tickets, then you use Social Speakers. You can check our social media for more information about that, meaning our Facebook and our Twitter. We have a new UFO report that we posted on Friday, so check that out on our YouTube for free. Also, go to openminds.tv, not just for all the stories that Martin and I talked about earlier, but you can also go there to join our email list. That's very important, because if you join our email list, then you'll be updated on everything that we do new, including specials and discounts. Getting on that email list is just so very, very important. And it's cool because I love putting them together, because it just shows, you know, over a two-week period, which is usually when we put them out every other week, if something really cool is going on, then we'll give you an update. And we've got a lot of cool stuff going on these days. But how much stuff we actually do in a couple weeks. Tons of great stories, podcasts, you know, YouTube videos. Oh, my gosh, we're hooking you guys up. And the reason that especially it's good to let you know about our podcast is because we've been a little bit infrequent lately. And I do apologize. You know, I'm only a day late on this one. I've just had a hard time scheduling guests recently for some reason. Just bad luck connecting with people and getting able to work with schedules and stuff. Which reminds me, you know, if you have someone that you would love to hear on the show, either have them on again or, you know, for the first time, let me know. Email us at contact@openminds.tv. Remember, that is contact@openminds.tv, and send us a suggestion or send it something over Facebook or wherever. That's cool too. But you all heard, I was very enthusiastic, you know, once I came back from vacation. Oh, I'm going to do shows and stuff like that. And I've been trying, people. But we're going to have a lot of great shows coming up. So no worries there. Otherwise, I guess that's all I got to say for now. Visit openminds.tv for more. And of course, the last people I like to thank are you all, the listeners. Thank you all so much for listening. And until next week, adios, muchachos.